Hello, everyone. Happy Sunday evening. I feel a little strange. It's kind of like when I was in Tiruvannamalai, like I forgot how to do everything, and I'm having to relearn how to do things again. It's the strangest thing. It's almost like I was in another world. And then coming, you know, I was there long enough to forget how this world works, you know, so it's odd. So we'll see if I remember how to do this teaching thing. I'm sure it will come back. But it's good to be here with you all again. And as Ken mentioned, we are here for the 7 steps to awakening. And tonight, we are going to begin with quote number 751. So if you have the 7 steps to awakening and you like to read along, you can open up to 751. And yeah, Kathy, that's it. I'm re-acclimating. And I'm guessing I'm not the only one. I mean, my guess is everyone who went on this trip is having the same strange re-entry experience. In fact, I would guess that it's very much like if we had gone to the moon or something and then came back here. You know, it's just so different. It's so different. So if you haven't been to Tiruvannamalai, if we go again, I really recommend it. I recommend going, or if we don't go again, going on your own. But it's nice when you haven't been there before to go with people who know their way around. What we did is we arrived in Chennai, and we hung out in Chennai for 2 or 3 days, and we had bus tours arranged there with a tour company, and then that tour company took us to Tiruvannamalai, and then the first 24 hours or so in Tiruvannamalai, what I did was I kind of gave everyone tours. You know, I walked them around and showed them where everything was, but then after that, we just set everybody loose. And we met every evening on the roof. Jasmine likes to make fun of Jasmine and Danielle make fun of the way I say roof. On the roof. On the roof of Ramana Towers. We met every night at 7:30. And had a little meeting there. But other than that, everybody was on their own all day long, every day. And everybody just kind of followed their own inner guidance and went where they were attracted to go. And most people spent a lot of time meditating or just being, a lot of time. And I think that's where the reentry challenge comes from, is because this life here, not only in America, but I'm sure in all of the Western nations, which is where all of our travelers were from. We were from all over the world, but we were all from Western nations. And yeah, we're busy bees, as Kathy is saying. It's a very busy life. And it can't be avoided. You know, to try and avoid that busy life when you come back would just be to fight what is. It can't be avoided. But it is very challenging to re-enter into that after having an opportunity to just be. And I think the reason it's so challenging is because just being is our natural state. And all of this busyness that we have created in this world is not natural. And so we became natural. And then we come back to this circumstance and we really have no choice but to, you know, try and catch up with this pace again. You know, it's kind of like we came off of a really slow island where we only hung out with very, you know, slow moving animals. And then we come back here and it's like a racehorse, you know, and we have no choice but to get back in the race. We really don't. I mean, like I said, it would just, you know, it would be fighting what is, but it takes a little bit of effort to get back into that. You know, it's challenging. And it's a little sad. It's sad for everyone. It's not selfishly sad. You know, it's not like, oh, woe is me. It's not that kind of sadness. It's sad for everyone to see what we have done to ourselves, to see how far we have taken ourselves away from the natural and how we've got ourselves into this very fast pace. It's very sad. So I'm catching up as best I can, getting back into the gallop as best I can. But it doesn't feel, I'm not completely acclimated again. It doesn't feel natural. Yeah. It doesn't feel natural. So what I'm going to do is play a song. This is a new favorite song of mine sent to me by a friend. And when he sent this song to me, I wondered if he lived inside my heart and mind. The song was so perfect for me right now. The name of the song is Be the One. So here we go. I have no idea where my volume is. I haven't touched this thing in ages, so we'll find out. I'm going to turn it down and then maybe turn it up so I don't blast you. How's that sound? I'll turn it down a little bit and then we'll gradually turn it up.
Gonna climb.
I'm here. I just didn't feel like running into the speaking. It is really wonderful just to be. And in fact, just being feels so wonderful. That busyness seems like madness by comparison. So, opening up the seven steps to awakening, quote number 751, when a dream object perishes, nothing is lost. When the world or the I is lost, nothing is lost. When a dream object perishes, nothing is lost. When the world or the I is lost, nothing is lost. Let me share the journal link with you. There you are. This is what it says in the journal. What keeps me attached to I? It is the idea that I am the mind. If I thought I was the hair, I would never want to cut the hair. But I don't think I am the hair, even though there may be vanity regarding it. Why is the attachment to thought so strong? Thought, which comes and goes and lives but an instant. Can I look at this attachment long enough? And with enough steadiness that it is seen through? Am I willing for this looking? You heard me giggle as I was reading the journal entry. I love this line. And by the way, this was written on August 18, 2013. I love this line. If I thought I was hair, I would never want to cut the hair. Isn't that funny? If I thought I was hair, I would never want to cut the hair, right? It kind of reminds me of the story in the Bible about Samson. Do you remember that story in the Bible about Samson? His strength was in his hair, right? And his enemies knew that his strength was in his hair. And so they sent a beautiful woman, Delilah, I think, wasn't that her name? Delilah, to fall in love with him and for him to fall in love with her. And then once they were deeply in love, asked, you know, to have Delilah cut his hair, I think, while he was sleeping so that he lost his strength. Samson and Delilah, I think that was her name. But yeah, if I thought that I was the hair, or if I thought my strength was in my hair, you know, I would be like Samson. I would never want to cut the hair. Well, that's the way we are with the mind. You know, no matter how much we come into awakening together or wherever else we go and we talk about I am not my thoughts, most of us are still deeply identified with our thoughts. And you can see that when you get caught in certain conversations, you know, like I've been gone for a while, but I think the political scene is still hot in America. So some people may notice when they get to talking about, you know, what's happening in politics in America right now, they may notice that they're getting a little hot under the collar. If they talk to someone who disagrees with them, someone who has a different point of view, they may notice some contraction within them, right? Where does that contraction, when you're talking to someone who disagrees with you about the political scene, where does that contraction come from? That comes from a very strong identification with your thoughts. That comes from you thinking that the strength of who you are is in your thoughts, your opinions, your point of views. And the reason you feel that constriction when someone disagrees with you is you feel like somebody's trying to cut your hair. Right? You feel it like Samson, like somebody's trying to cut your hair. They're trying to take away from you. By disagreeing with your thought system, they're trying to take away from you your strength. You feel attacked. And so if we could just shift our perspective a little bit, instead of thinking that, you know, my political opinions are so important, instead of thinking that way, I am so right about this political idea and things have to be my way or the world's going to go to hell, instead of thinking that way, if when we notice that constriction, we could look and say, ah, look how attached I am to my thoughts. I think I'm Samson, and I think that my strength is in my hair. Right? Look how attached I am to my thoughts. Kathy says it's hair-raising. One thing that I've noticed with some spiritual teachers even lately, because the political situation in America is so hot that lots of spiritual teachers are weighing in. You know, you can go on YouTube and you can find different spiritual teachers talking about Donald Trump. And what's interesting is some of the, you know, a couple of the teachers are truly enlightened. And you can tell because, you know, you start listening to their YouTube and what they're doing is using the political situation in exactly the same way I am right now. Using it to get you to look at your attachments, question your thoughts, let go of your attachment to mind. Let go of your belief that you are this person with this opinion and this point of view. A couple of them are doing that. But if I've listened to 10 teachers, 10 spiritual teachers on the subject of Donald Trump, only two of them, and I might have to include Regina Don Akers in the two because I can only think of myself and one other right now, that other being Byron Katie. But I'm going to give credit. Maybe there's another one, too, so we'll say three. Maybe if we include Regina, maybe three of them, although I can't think of who the third one is. Maybe three of them are using it to help us question our thoughts and question our attachment to mind. The others that I've heard speaking about it, have their own opinions, their own point of views. And they're sharing those as if somehow that's the truth. And unfortunately, spiritual students who have these spiritual teachers on pedestals and think these spiritual teachers know what the truth is, unfortunately, they're now saying, so if this teacher says, ... yeah, agendas, Phil. If this teacher says, ... then that must be right. And now I've got agreement with my thought system. Right? I've got agreement with my thought system, and my thought system is truth. That's like saying, see here? My strength is in my hair. And I know my strength is in my hair because my spiritual teacher just agreed with me. My points of view are right. My opinions are right. I, hear the I in that, I am more right, far more right than the people who disagree with me. Our strength is in our hair. How ridiculous is that? Yeah, and look at all the people who agree with me. That proves how right I am, doesn't it, Kathy? That I can find all these people who agree with me. And in my point of view, if this is the way I think, in my point of view, the fact that there are just as many people who disagree with me doesn't mean a dang thing, because they're just wrong. Yeah. But yeah, how do I feel? How do I feel when, let's say, my own mother or my brother or sometimes my spouse or my neighbor disagrees with me? When they feel just as strongly from the opposite point of view. Kathy says, upset, anxious, angry. And if I will look at that, justified, yeah, right. And if I will look at that, notice that, what's really happening, betrayed, what's really happening is that my thought system is being threatened. That's what's really happening. My thought system is being threatened. My identification with my thought system is being threatened. Someone is trying to cut my hair. So why don't we just let them cut it? Why don't we let it fall to the ground? Why don't we let them rip our thought system to shreds and just stand there and do nothing while it falls apart around us? Isn't that what we say we're here for? Don't we claim to ourselves and others that we are here for the undoing of the ego? Then why fight it when somebody starts ripping our ego to shreds? Why not just let them? Aren't they doing us a favor if they cut our hair? For those of you who have joined us, in case this sounds like a crazy conversation to you, talking about cutting hair, let me just go back and review what we're looking at. We're looking at a quote in the Seven Steps to Awakening, quote number 751. This is the quote. When a dream object perishes, nothing is lost. When the world or the I is lost, nothing is lost. So what are we defending when we defend our thought system, our point of view, our attachment to our ideas? We're defending nothing. A false strength. When a dream object perishes, nothing is lost. When the world or the I is lost, nothing is lost. So why don't we just let them do it? Tear our thought system to shreds. Why defend? Why fight for my point of view? Let them help us rip our hair out by the roots. So For those of you, again, who have just joined us, this analogy with hair that I'm using comes from the journal entry. Let me read the journal entry. What keeps me attached to I? It is the idea that I am the mind. If I thought I was the hair, I would never want to cut the hair. But I don't think I am the hair, even though there may be vanity regarding it. Why is the attachment to thought so strong? Thought, which comes and goes and lives but an instant. Can I look at this attachment long enough and with enough steadiness that it is seen through? Am I willing for this looking? One thing that's happened recently, which I find kind of interesting, is that a few different people have asked me in the last, couple of months, what is willingness? I find that kind of interesting. That the ego could be so complicated that it can confuse us on such a simple thing that we have to ask, what is willingness? And in fact, the first time somebody asked me, and I can't remember who it was, I think it might even have been Rick Archer, but if not him, it was someone else who was interviewing me around that same time. I was also interviewed by Dr. David Kanitzer. I don't know, I think that's how you say his last name. So it could have been him. But someone who was interviewing me was asking me, what is willingness? And I couldn't even come up with a definition. Not because I don't know what it is, but because I know willingness so intimately that I never thought about having to define it for someone else. I thought it was just one of these things that everybody knew. But since that first person asked me what is willingness, several others have asked, and I've had to stop and think about it and look for a definition. I had to come up with something. And what I came up with feels kind of like it's pale in comparison to what willingness really is. Probably like any words about the truth are pale in comparison to what the truth really is, right? But this is what I came up with. That willingness means I consent with my free will. See how the word will, free will is in there? Willingness. I consent with my free will to this. I am not coerced. I am not doing this against my will. I have willingness. And so this journal entry says, can I look at this attachment to thought long enough and with enough steadiness that it is seen through? Am I willing for this looking? So let's say for a moment that we just say yes. Yes, I'm willing. It's easy to say yes. How do we know? How do we know if we're willing to pay attention to thought long enough to see through our attachment to thought, long enough to see that it doesn't make sense, long enough to lose interest in the attachment, long enough to see the foolishness or the insanity of the attachment. How do we know if we really consent to that with our own free will? I think the answer is because we begin to do it. Maybe a little at first. Maybe, 20 minutes a day, we begin to do some journaling or some meditating or something and looking. And the rest of the day, we still don't look. But that's the little willingness, right? The 20 minutes a day is a little willingness. If we don't even give 20 minutes a day to noticing our attachment to thought, questioning our attachment to thought, if we don't even give 20 minutes a day, then I don't think that we can say that we're willing. We don't even have a little willingness. There's a lot of things that we are doing with our time, a lot of things that we do consent to. And depending on who we are, that could be anything. But if we're not giving any time at all to noticing the thoughts that we believe, to questioning the thoughts that we believe, to questioning the sanity of believing our thoughts, if we're not beginning to pay attention and really look at that and examine that, then we don't have willingness. We're not consenting to it yet with our own free will. So for me, willingness has some action in it. I think whoever it was that asked me, whether it was Rick Archer or Dr. David Chemnitzer, again, I couldn't even think of a definition. It never occurred to me that not everyone knew what willingness was, because it was just so natural for me. I think this is one reason in NTI willingness is brought up so many times, because when the inner voice spoke to me about willingness, I knew exactly what it was talking about. I never had a question about that. I knew it intimately. I knew what willingness was. I knew what it felt like. I knew when I was living from willingness and when I wasn't. And again, I thought that's the way it was for everyone. I didn't know that other people didn't know what willingness was. So when the first person asked me that question, what's willingness? I was like, wow. I couldn't even think of how to answer it without using the word in the definition. I remember I said something like, well, it's like a child, it's like a baby. A baby is willing to learn to walk. It's natural. How do you know? Well, they're trying to learn to walk. I mean, that's they're doing it. There's action there. They get up, they fall down, they get up again, they fall down, they keep trying. They're totally willing to learn to walk. There's action in it. Action that comes from our own free will. From our consent. Our willingness to see that our attachment to our own thinking is foolish. Our willingness to see that our own thinking makes no sense. Our willingness to realize that our own thinking is the cause of our suffering. But there's action in it. Inquiry is happening. Looking is happening. Journaling is happening. Meditation is happening. Maybe listening to some teachers that are teaching us how to inquire, how to journal, how to meditate, right? But there's action in it. Again, the journal entry says, "What keeps me attached to I?" It is the idea that I am the mind. If I thought I was the hair, I would never want to cut the hair. But I don't think I am the hair, even though there may be vanity regarding it. Why is the attachment to thought so strong? Thought, which comes and goes and lives but an instant. Can I look at this attachment? You see, there's the action right there. Looking at the attachment. Can I look at this attachment, like questioning the attachment, examining the attachment? Can I look at this attachment long enough and with enough steadiness, right? Because looking just once, for most of us anyway, isn't enough. We don't just look once, see the insanity once, and drop the attachment. Most of us have to keep looking, keep looking, keep questioning, right? It's an ongoing, consistent process, an ongoing, consistent action. In the teachings of Inner Ramana likens it to having a razor blade and rubbing against a rope. Every time we look, every time we inquire into the attachment to thought, it's like rubbing a razor blade across the rope. And most of us have to rub that razor blade across the rope many, many, many times before it finally cuts all the way through and the attachment to thought is broken. So can I look at this attachment long enough and with enough steadiness that it is seen through? Am I willing for this looking? Is there action in it? Do I find this in my daily life? This looking, this questioning. This is healthy doubt, right? Healthy doubt. In fact, Inner Ramana called it the doubter phase. This doubting that my thoughts make sense, this doubting that I am the mind, this healthy doubt. Is this a part of my daily life? And I guess the question then could be, if not, why not? If not, why not? Some of you, I think, were offended, actually, about a year ago, a little less than a year ago, when Ellie Ruzdar was here. And Ellie Ruzdar said something about, that many people on the spiritual path aren't really ready for the spiritual path and they should just leave the spiritual path. And, I know people were offended because of the emails that I got. But, really, if I'm not putting action into spiritual practice, if I'm not doing something to break this attachment to mind, to break the belief that I am my thoughts, then why am I here? Why waste my time? It seems like we might as well either put action into our spiritual path or go do something else. This straddling the fence thing. What is it? Isn't there a a song by The Doors. I could be completely wrong about this, but isn't there a song by The Doors about straddling the fence and, hurting my balls? I think, so pardon the expression, but I think that's in the song. Not, I'm sorry, I heard that somewhere. Isn't that what happens if you're a guy anyway? We can all pretend like we're guys for a second. The son of God, remember? So, you know, we're straddling the fence. Doesn't that hurt? Why suffer? Why not just pick a side and get on that side of the fence? If we're ready to put action into our spiritual path, then heck yeah, let's jump on the spiritual side of the fence with both feet. But if we aren't willing, if we don't consent to using our time in order to question this believing, this attachment to mind, then why not get on the other side of the fence and just enjoy whatever it is in the world that we enjoy and forget about the spiritual path for now? Why suffer with straddling the fence? Pick a side and have fun with whichever side you pick. Do it or forget about it. And be happy either way. And know that it's your decision. Know that if you are doing it, it's because you're willing. You're consenting with this from your free will. This is what you have decided to do with this lifetime. This is what you want. So why pretend like you don't want to? You do. You made the decision. Nobody made you. You chose this side of the fence. So throw yourself into it. Make this what your life is about. Or go do something else. Whatever else your heart calls you to. You know, learn a sport, learn to play music, learn some kind of a craft, fall in love, you know, learn to cook, and throw yourself into that. Do whatever you're willing to do. Follow your free will. Follow your consent. And know that it's your free will. Know that it's your choice. And throw yourself completely into it. And there are teachers out there who can help you with that side of the fence too, actually. There are teachers out there that can really help you live up to your highest desire in the world, right? And sometimes I think that's what people need to do. People who aren't truly willing for the spiritual path, who aren't ready to throw themselves into the practice of the spiritual path, sometimes I think it's because they still have this lingering idea that something else will make them happy. And they need to go and they need to try that and get it out of their system, you could say. You know, one of the things I got out of my system in this lifetime, and I think, and although I enjoyed it completely and I threw myself completely into it, I if there's another lifetime, I don't think I'm going to have to do it again because I think I got it out of my system. What I wanted in this lifetime was to have a child. I wanted it deeply. And I don't know that I could have gone through this lifetime happily without satisfying that desire. And so I had a child. And, you know, there were a lot of apparent miracles that led to me getting that child. I won't sit here and tell the story, but if I did, there's just like miracle after miracle after miracle. It's like the universe was even on my side in accomplishing that desire. The universe didn't punish me for wanting to have a child, for having a worldly desire. It was there, my God, handing me miracle after miracle after miracle that led to that experience. And I got this beautiful child, this wonderful child. I mean, I can't think of a better child than the one that I got. It was a magnificent life raising her, a wonderful relationship, lots of fun. And that desire in me was fully satisfied. So satisfied that now I'm able to let her go. I mean, don't get me wrong, I still love her, you know, but I'm able to let her go. I don't have to be one of those parents who's still filling out the parenting role, like some parents do, with an adult child. I can let my child go. I can let her be an adult. I can enjoy her when she comes home for a visit. But I can let her go, and I can put my attention elsewhere now because my desire was satisfied. You see, I can forget about it because I completed it. I threw myself into it. And sometimes I think people need to do that. I think that's what's keeping them straddling the fence, because they just have this desire that isn't really the spiritual path. It isn't, you know, watching the mind and journaling and meditating. It's something else, right? And it's such a strong desire that sometimes I think they just need to go. They need to go and do that. And after you go and really throw yourself into it. I mean, I didn't judge myself for wanting to be a mother. I didn't hold back because I thought wanting to be a mother was wrong. In fact, those thoughts never crossed my mind. I threw myself into it. I was the best mother I knew how to be. You should watch the videos of Jasmine and me when she was young. We just every weekend, something we did together, you know, just really, I mean, just I threw myself completely into being a parent. And I could stare at her face for hours. Just stare at her face brought me so much joy. And I let myself feel all of that joy. But do you know why even that desire, which really did bring me great, great, great joy, do you know why that desire, that being a parent, isn't the answer like awakening is the answer? Because being a parent is temporary. Jasmine grew so fast. I mean, I blinked and the baby was no longer a baby, it was a toddler. And then I blinked again, and the toddler wasn't a toddler. She was a preschooler. And then she was an elementary schooler, and then an older elementary schooler, and then a young teenager, and then an older teenager, and then she started college, and now she's almost halfway through that. I mean, you know, you can't hold on to being a mother. It grows right out of your hands. And that's the way it's going to be with any worldly joy. It's not that you won't love being a cook, if that's your thing. It's not that you won't love being a tennis player, if that's your thing. It's not that you won't love being an artist, if that's your thing, or a singer, or whatever. It's just that whatever that thing is, it can't be eternal. So you can throw yourself into it, you can love it, you can get joy from it, it can be magnificent, but then at some point it's going to be done. The only thing that isn't going to disappear is self-realization. So eventually, for everyone, there will come a time when we are ready. We are willing to throw ourselves into that. But if it's not your time, if you're not willing, if you don't find action in it for you, that's not a sin. You're not guilty. You're not bad. Just find out what you are willing for. find out what you do want to throw yourself into and throw yourself into that. Maybe that needs to be satisfied first. Maybe it's a joy you got to taste first, and that's okay. And then come back when you're willing for this. When you're ready for this. When this is what you want to do with your time. Yeah, Phil is saying the prodigal son didn't know what home was till he left it. He needed that experience. So again, we're looking at quote 751 from the Seven Steps to Awakening. When a dream object perishes, nothing is lost. When the world or the I is lost, nothing is lost. And I want to read this a little differently. It's not the quote, but it's what I hear in my mind every time I read the quote. So I'm going to surrender to it, and I'm going to edit this quote a little bit. God forgive me for editing the quote of an enlightened master. But here we go. This is how I keep hearing it. When a dream world perishes, nothing is lost. When the world or the I perishes, nothing is lost. What is perishable mean? Right? Like fruits and vegetables are perishable. Doesn't it mean that they're temporary? And that they're going to have an end? Non-eternal, yeah. Well, isn't that what we're saying, that everything of the world is perishable? Isn't that what I said a moment ago about being a mother? Even though being a mother was a great, great joy, and I absolutely loved it, I'm not going to pretend like I didn't, you know? It was perishable. It ended. And there isn't anything in the world that isn't perishable. The person that you think you are right now is perishable. It will end. You can live that life, you know, like a humanist. I went to a Unitarian Universalist church just one day here in Pueblo. Those of us who were living here, we went and tried it out one day. It's on the other side of town. And as it turns out, this particular Unitarian Universalist church, because, you know, they each have their own culture, this particular one was a humanist. And basically, from what I could tell, what they believed is that, you know, it's really in biology, as if biology is truth, that you live and then you die and that's the end. You know, that's kind of my dad's point of view, you know, humanist, biology. Biology is truth. But what they were saying is while you have this life during this temporary period of time, you know, what a humanist teaches, their religion is live this life as well as you can. And that includes morality. That includes goodness. That includes helping others. You know, this is their religion, right? A humanist is not trying to be selfish, although the ego is always selfish and it can't help it. But their intention is not a selfish intention, right? You know, live this temporary life as good as you can. So you can do that, right? You, Danielle, you, George, you, Lynn, you, Kathy, you, Madeline, etc. You can live this Danielle life, this George life, this Lynn life, this Kathy life, this Madeline life. You can live this life as good as you can. And it's perishable. You can throw yourself into being a Danielle, right? But it's perishable. Just like being a mother for me was perishable. What isn't perishable? Jesus called that eternal life. The opposite of perishable is eternal life. What is eternal life? Eternal life is self-realization, realizing your truth, And you can't think you are the person. I'm going to use Danielle as an example because she's my dear friend and she's in the room. So you can't think you are Danielle and know yourself as the self too. It's not possible. So you're either picking a perishable project, something that's going to have an end, or you're throwing yourself into the purpose of realizing eternal life. And what this quote is saying is that eternal life has value. And the perishable really doesn't, because it was going to end anyway. Right? It just doesn't. It doesn't have real value. You know, also when Ellie Ruzdar was here, remember she talked about how if you offer a 3-year-old an ice cream cone or a diamond worth $10 million and ask them which one do they want, they'd pick the ice cream cone. That ice cream cone's pretty perishable, right? You either have to lick it or it's going to melt, right? It's very perishable, but yeah, they'll pick it every time. But then she used the example of like maybe a 40-year-old man. If you offer him the ice cream cone or the $10 million diamond, he's going to take that $10 million diamond. Now, of course, even $10 million is perishable, but for a moment, we'll let that represent the eternal. He knows that the eternal has more value. Losing the ice cream cone for the diamond is nothing. Letting it perish, just letting the ice cream cone melt without even taking a lick. Just saying no to the ice cream cone, leave it laying on the sidewalk and just let it melt away and let the ants eat the cone and never tasting it. That's not a loss when what you have is the diamond. There's no value by comparison. So the way my mind keeps hearing the quote is, when a dream object perishes, when the ice cream cone melts, nothing is lost because I have the diamond. When the world or the I perishes, nothing is lost because I have the diamond. And if I realize that to any degree, then I may have the willingness to put action into the spiritual path, to throw myself into the spiritual path instead of into cooking or whatever. Throw myself into the spiritual path and go for the diamond. You remember what Jesus said? Jesus said that a man found a treasure, a buried treasure. He went, he sold everything that he had. He came back and he bought that field where the treasure was. Do you remember? Selling everything that we have is realizing that it's the ice cream cone. It has no value. And it's throwing ourselves completely into the willingness, the action that will lead to self-realization. So just let me read this journal entry one more time and then my time is up. What keeps me attached to I? It is the idea that I am the mind. If I thought I was the hair, I would never want to cut the hair. But I don't think I am the hair, even though there may be vanity regarding it. Why is the attachment to thought so strong? Thought, which comes and goes and lives but an instant, it's perishable. Can I look at this attachment long enough and with enough steadiness that it's seen through, that I see it has no value, that I see it's just the ice cream cone? Am I willing for this looking? Will I use my time for this? Will I put action into it? And that's all of my time. Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.